It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up in Wisconsin's latest round of school testing, fourth grade reading scores dropped and lagged behind the rest of the country. We'll dig into those numbers with a WPR reporter. First, President Trump announced earlier this week that he would meet with his advisors to determine a U.S. military response to an alleged chemical attack in the Syrian city of Douma this weekend. The suspected assault left dozens of Syrians dead and many more injured. President Trump has had some harsh words for those believed to be behind the attack. Many groups have blamed Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's forces and have pointed the finger at his backers, Russia and Iran. On Twitter, President Trump singled out Russia specifically. But no announcement has been made, and the president seemingly dialed down his rhetoric at a White House meeting this morning. Our next guest is here to talk about how the United States could respond. Gordon Adams is professor emeritus in the School of International Service at American University and distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center. He specializes in military policy. Gordon, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we heard an announcement this afternoon that French President Emmanuel Macron has proof that a chemical attack did occur this weekend. And with this in mind, do you think that the military response, if any, will be a coordinated action between the United States, France, and possibly other countries?
I think that's quite likely. I don't think anybody expected that it wasn't a case of regime use of chemical weapons, so it's hardly surprising that the proof should begin to emerge. And the president pretty clearly signaled over the past week that, some discussions needed to be underway with the French, with the British, potentially with some countries in the region about coordinating some kind of military response.
I want to talk about a couple of the president's tweets on this issue. He wrote, initially, Russia vows to shoot down any and all missiles fired at Syria. Get ready, Russia, because they will be coming nice and new and smart. And then in the last couple of days, he's tweeted, never said when an attack on Syria would take place. Could be very soon or not so soon at all. Mixed messages from the president?
Well, I think the president's mixed messages go further abroad than that because, of course, a week before he decided he would say things relatively bellicose about chemical weapons and missile attacks, he had said he was asking his generals to withdraw American troops quite quickly from the northeastern area of Syria. So there's a kind of a yin and a yang approach that seems to be going on here, and the message is not always clear from the president. It's clearly not the president who's developing the options. It's clearly the Defense Department that's developing the options. What's missing here is a diplomatic strategy. We have no sense of the diplomacy, and in fact, no Secretary of State in position. Pompeo is having his hearing today, so there's no diplomatic strategy to accompany us. It's kind of disorderly as an approach, but fundamentally, the president's instinct seems to be keep America out of difficulty here, but at the same time, impose with force some kind of position on Assad. An imposition by force, by the way, which I think is probably not going to be terribly effective. It's going to be a pinprick as it was a year ago. Assad does not seem to be deterred by these missile strikes. He's used chemical weapons more than 80 times since the war began on his own people, and has been, quite frankly, prepared to ride out any response that might have come from the United States or any other country.
Without a diplomatic strategy in place, as you say, is any sort of military intervention going to be effective if we don't have that diplomatic goal in mind?
No, in fact, my view is that a military strategy alone here is likely to be ineffective. The use of missiles here are not going to change his use of chemical weapons. What's more, keeping American troops in the northeastern area or enlarging that ground force is not going to be terribly effective either without a diplomatic strategy. The Pentagon in particular seems to be arguing that we need to keep those troops in place because we can stabilize the region, we can rebuild, we can deter the Russians, the Turks, and the Iranians in the country. We can actually buy ourselves a place at the negotiating table for the diplomacy. But the reality is those troops can do none of those things. We blew our copybook on reconstruction and stability in Iraq. We're not very good at it. Assad has not really cared. He's very grateful we've mopped up ISIS, but surely not worried about 2,000 American soldiers. And in any case, it's the Kurds who mopped up ISIS, not the American troops. And, the key players here are the Russians, the Iranians, the Turks, and Assad. And those four are meeting in peace talks. They've been meeting to try to look at how to resolve the Civil War now several times without the Americans even being at the table. Troops or more troops are not going to buy us a place at the table. We're kind of a bit player in this circumstance.
You mentioned a few American goals there, a seat at the table in diplomacy, rebuilding, also destroying ISIS has been part of the mission, containing Russian influence in the region, maybe protecting the Kurds could get on this list. Have we ever, under President Obama or President Trump, really had a coherent mindset about what we want to come out of Syria with?
No, although I would say we have significantly greater chaos today than we had with Obama. Obama worked through aspects of a strategy, worked on diplomatic approaches, drew that red line and then did not act on the red line that he had drawn. Personally, I think he was absolutely right not to act on it, probably a mistake to draw it in the first place. But he clearly had a strategic view of how the United States should, and this is very important, keep its distance from deep engagement in the Syrian conflict itself. What Trump seems to be saying is both get deeply engaged and don't get deeply engaged at the same time. That's not only confusing to our allies, it's not likely to be terribly helpful on the ground.
Talking to Gordon Adams from American University about Syria and the American response, the potential American response to a chemical weapons attack there over the weekend. Want to give a listen to President Trump. He was asked by reporters about the U.S. response in Syria at a meeting mainly to discuss agriculture. Here's a listen.
We're having a meeting today on Syria. We're having a number of meetings today. We'll see what happens. We're obviously looking at that very closely. And I will be leaving here. I was there, and now I'll be going back as soon as this meeting is over. But we're looking very, very seriously, very closely at that whole situation, and we'll see what happens, folks. We'll see what happens. It's too bad that the world puts us in a position like that. But, you know, as I said this morning, we've done a great job with ISIS. We have just absolutely decimated ISIS, but now we have to make some further decisions. So they'll be made fairly soon.
So not a lot of definite ideas there, but not as, bellicose as some of his earlier tweets on the Syrian reaction.
You know, this is a very unpredictable president. We've beginning to learn to live with that. It's not quite clear what his policy is here. A year ago, he sent 59 Tomahawk cruise missiles into Syria as a kind of a warning shot about one of the last uses of chemical weapons by Assad. It made absolutely no difference in terms of Assad's use. There are people who say because he made his statement about potentially withdrawing troops, that emboldened Assad to use chemical weapons. I think, frankly, that's nonsense. It didn't embolden him at all. He's used them more than 80 times. He's prepared to ride out any U.S. military response. The real problem for Trump and for the administration is a twofold problem. One is we are a bit player. We have a very, very weak hand to play there. And more troops and more missiles are not going to buy us a stronger hand. And two, the administration simply has no diplomatic counterpart of a military strategy. We simply don't know what the Americans would think the future of Syria ought to be, how the powers that are there ought to relate to each other. There's no diplomatic vision. So having no strategy, throwing more missiles, leaving troops, taking troops away, none of that is going to fit with a grand strategy for Syria.
If we're a bit player there now, should we accept that role and not try to interject ourselves in whatever a post-war peace looks like, if there's a post-war peace coming in Syria?
In my view, we absolutely should. There's no reason why the Russians, who have been there for decades, should be interested in an American role. The Turks don't seem terribly interested in an American role. The Iranians are not enthusiastic about it. And it looks like Assad is going to survive in Damascus. He certainly is not going to be enthusiastic about an American role. So even viewing a way the Americans might intrude themselves is rather difficult. My own view is that we would do well to basically stand at the periphery. Let events take the process that they're going to take, mop up on ISIS because there's still a little bit left of ISIS, bring the American troops home, and allow the parties in the region and in the country to settle the situation. We cannot settle it. That's going to be hard for some Americans to accept. But nonetheless, I think it's very realistic.
Do we have a role to play in the humanitarian nightmare with millions of people displaced within Syria and outside of its borders? in addition to the chemical weapon attacks, barrel bombings, and other atrocities against civilians, do we have a role to play in at least calling that out?
Absolutely. And here the difficulty is that the administration 2 weeks ago put on hold $200 million worth of primarily humanitarian assistance. So even where we can, we're not playing the same role that we played in humanitarian assistance. It would be, I think, very ill-advised for the United States to assume it would have a greater role in Syria in any way in the reconstruction and stabilization of the country. The military is not going to be allowed in big numbers to do that. If it is, it will provoke more disturbance. And we're not really capable of stabilizing, governing, or reconstructing countries in the Middle East. We certainly have proved that in Iraq and in South Asia. We've proved it in Afghanistan. We're not the greatest reconstructors you can imagine.
Is there any kind of international framework, whether it comes to the United Nations or I don't know who, that might present a better alternative for Syria than the Syrian government, the Russian government, the Iranians, and Turkey?
I don't think there's any other setting where it's going to be acceptable to any of those parties. Those, along with Hezbollah and at the periphery Israel, are going to be the countries that are involved in the future in Syria. The United States is not going to be terribly involved militarily. It does not have a diplomatic strategy. We will be a small player. This is a part of a broader issue for the United States right now, I think, that is to accept the fact that we are not the indispensable nation, the resolver of security issues in every arena of the world, and particularly in the Middle East. In the last 15 or 20 years, we have performed so poorly in that region that we've burned our own credibility.
Briefly, if I could maybe oversimplify here, a lot of people might have a bad feeling about this because, in a sense, if Assad stays in power, the bad guys won here.
That's right. And, you know, unfortunately, and he is a bad guy, unfortunately, sometimes the bad guys do win.
We'll leave it there. Gordon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Gordon Adams, Professor Emeritus in the School of International Service at American University and a distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center. He joined us to talk about the potential military response from the U.S. in Syria after alleged chemical weapons attacks by the regime there and President Trump's relationship with the armed forces and his policy in the Middle East. The latest round of national testing for 4th and 8th graders has finished up, and one of the big takeaways is a drop in 4th grade reading scores over the last year for students in Wisconsin. And while racial achievement gaps in the states have narrowed, some, they remain among the biggest in the country. Education officials are pointing to the numbers as a sign that there's more work to be done to boost performance in the classroom. Kyla Calvert-Mason is assistant news director here at Wisconsin Public Radio. She's been reporting on what's called the Nation's Report Card. Kyla, thanks for joining us today.
Sure, my pleasure.
Well, kids in schools take a lot of tests over the course of the year. Can you tell us about these particular tests and why people watch these pretty closely?
Sure. This is called the National Assessment of Educational Progress, or NAEP, and it's also known as the Nation's Report Card. So every other year, there are these national exams given to a sort of statistical sampling of students across the country and in fourth and eighth grade. And then there are also other tests for 12th graders, but they're not included in this report. And what makes it different from all of the other standardized tests that students are taking is that it's the same test across the country. So other standardized tests are just at the state level. And so this is sort of the one measure where you're comparing apples to apples across the entire country, how students are doing in Wisconsin versus Florida or California or Oklahoma, etc.
So it does two things, kind of. It allows us to compare state to state over time, but also within a state, it gives us this over time progress and change measurement, too. Is that right?
Exactly.
So what are we seeing this year? A lot of people are looking at the fourth grade reading numbers in particular. What did we see there?
Sure. Wisconsin was one of nine states where fourth graders' reading performance actually declined. So overall, sort of the big takeaway across the country this year for these tests was very little change. Students are sort of just plateauing on these tests in math and reading. But in Wisconsin, fourth grade reading declined.
And when you talk to people who are experts and people who track this, is there a lot of worry in a one-year decline?
No, I mean, there's noise in every, you know, sort of exam like this. A one-year decline is not necessarily cause for concern. And, you know, the test changes every year. And also, this was the first year that students took it on tablets versus paper and pencil. So there were definitely school leaders across the country saying, you know, we have to account for this. Students in general perform more, you know, not as well on tests on tablets as they do on paper tests. But the people who manage this test at the national level said, oh, we accounted for that when we sort of set the scores that determine whether students are, you know, at below basic, basic, proficient, or advanced, which is sort of how student scores are grouped for the results for this test.
That said, even if we don't want to read too much into this, the happy face result is that numbers go up from year to year, right?
Sure, exactly. And, you know, what when I spoke with the Department of Public Instruction spokesman, he said that what the reading scores tell him is that, you know, Wisconsin students have really sort of plateaued in this area. There have not been big increases or significant increases for fourth grade reading in the state on this test for the last decade or so. And across the country, the scores have sort of continued to increase. So whereas 10 or more years ago, Wisconsin was sort of a leader in this area, now sort of bumping along right in the middle.
The fourth grade reading was just one of the results here. There's also fourth grade math and then eighth grade math and reading. How did we do on those measures?
So the sort of takeaway on those results was no statistical change because it's a a representative sample of students versus sort of every student in the state. There were some small changes in the average score on those tests, but the changes weren't big enough to say definitively, oh, this is an increase or a decrease. So it was sort of no change in those areas.
We're looking at Wisconsin students' performance on a national assessment test. Kyla Calvert-Mason is with us, assistant news director at Wisconsin Public Radio. A big concern, Kyla, in Wisconsin over the past bunch of years has been racial disparities when it comes to educational performance. What kind of things, is that something that these tests measure, first of all? And if so, what did we see there?
Yeah, this test, what education reporters, for example, really like about it is that the testing data is available for lots of different subgroups of students. So racial subgroups, students who qualify for free and reduced price lunch, which means they're from lower income households versus students who don't, even by parents' education level. So there's a lot of different ways to look at how different groups of students are performing. So when it comes to the gap between white students and black students in particular, Wisconsin continues to have some of the very largest gaps in the country on these tests. So in fourth grade math and eighth grade reading, Wisconsin posted the second largest gaps between those two groups of students in the country. Only Washington, D.C. had larger gaps between white and black students. In eighth grade math and the state had the third largest gap between white and black students. And in fourth grade reading, it had the fifth largest gap between white and black students. And on those two tests, the eighth grade math and the fourth grade reading, that's actually an improvement from previous years. Those gaps narrowed somewhat, and Wisconsin sort of fell down the list a little bit.
With the test like that, especially when it comes to the racial disparities, in a way it may be telling Wisconsin education officials things they already know. That said, are these tests a guide for action, for policy, for schools, and for the Department of Public Instruction?
I think a lot of different people point at test results to, you know, make the case for whatever argument it is they're putting forward. So people use these test results in a lot of different ways to support a lot of different arguments. And, you know, as you said, the gap between students of different racial and ethnic backgrounds is something that, you know, educators in the state are well aware of. And that's actually, again, when I spoke to the Department of Public Instruction spokesman, he said that that's actually sign of for hope in this area, because he said, you know, as Wisconsin has become more diverse in the last decade, this is something that people, in his estimation, are much more willing to talk about now than they were, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. You can't really say that, you know, these aren't larger groups of students now when it comes to African-American students, Hispanic students. And so with people more willing to talk about the disparity, you know, acknowledge it and focus on it, that there is, you know, more of a chance of actually addressing it.
As you mentioned earlier, there are other tests that states use, including Wisconsin. How does this national test fit into the puzzle here, given that Wisconsin also administers its own assessment tests of students?
Well, like I said, it's, you know, the only exam where you can really compare across state lines how students are doing. So I think it's probably not the test that educators are paying the very most attention to, because it's not testing every student. You know, the Wisconsin Forward exam, every spring, almost every student in the state between grades, you know, 3 and 8 is taking that test. And that's really one that educators are paying attention to when it comes to assessing what's going on in their schools.
Kyla, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
My pleasure.
Kyla Calvert-Mason is Assistant News Director here at Wisconsin Public Radio. She was with us to talk about new state test scores in reading and math for Wisconsin's 4th and 8th grade students. Roughly 13% of all public school students in the United States receive services from their school's special education systems. As these students make their way through high school, are they being challenged and encouraged enough to find success and satisfaction after graduation? According to the Hechinger Report, a nonprofit news organization focused on education, up to 90% of students with disabilities around the nation are capable of graduating high school on time with a traditional diploma. Despite this, only about 65% graduate on time, and when they do, they're not necessarily prepared for the next step. So what's happening here in Wisconsin? Daniel Parker is the assistant director of the special education team at the state's Department of Public Instruction. Daniel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It's great to be here with you today.
Well, can you start by talking about what schools are required to do by law, as I understand it, to assist students with disabilities or other special educational needs?
Yes. So there's a federal law called the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA, that requires that school districts first identify students with disabilities. It's a portion of the law that people refer to as child find. So school districts are looking for evaluating and identifying students with disabilities through a referral process. So parents can refer, teachers can refer, others refer, some school districts hold screenings and do other types of activities around child find so that there's a referral process. And then once the child is referred, the district is responsible for doing evaluation to determine whether or not a student has a disability and requires special education services.
And this could cover a lot of ground, anywhere from developmental disabilities to physical disabilities or learning disorders. There's a lot of different things that could fall under this. So obviously there's not like a one-size-fits-all approach that's going to work for every student here, right?
No, and one of the things that we really promote at the Department of Public Instruction is a comprehensive evaluation, so that when a referral is made, you're looking at all possible areas of disability. You're really getting understanding of the whole child. You're looking also at that student's strengths and assets that can help them in learning, as well as the areas that they need assistance. And a complete and thorough comprehensive evaluation looks at all of those factors. The Individuals with Disability Education Act does have some federally identified impairment areas. Such common ones people have heard of is specific learning disability, autism, intellectual disability are a few. But IEP teams, you know, so the evaluation teams will look at which of those areas a student may qualify for, and if that student needs special education and specially designed instruction to be able to access, engage, and make progress in their general education program.
Before we dig deeper into how that works in Wisconsin, that report, that national report we looked at, mentioned that a number of states, over 20 states, have an alternative to the traditional high school diploma, often for people with disabilities, but it's controversial because it's not really equivalent in the eyes, say, of an employer or of a college. Do we have something like that here in Wisconsin?
So currently we do not have something like that in Wisconsin, and I know that we very much promote having students with disabilities, students who qualify for special education programs with an individualized education program or IEP, that they are provided the supports, the specially designed instruction, the accommodations that they would really need to be able to fully access, engage, and make progress in their general education program so that they can be on track to receive a traditional graduation degree and certificate.
And one concern, again, raised in this report at least, and in the minds of people too, is that is the focus here getting kids across the finish line, that being graduating, or is there enough focus on being prepared after graduation, whether that's college or a career? How does the state approach that?
Yeah. So in Wisconsin, our state superintendent, Tony Evers, has the vision of every student college and career ready. And, you know, working on the special education team and before working at DPI, working for 15 years in the field, supporting students with disabilities, students with IEPs, that's very near and dear to my heart. And when we think of every student, we're thinking of each and every student. And it's not important, you know, the academic content is definitely important for students to learn to be successful after high school. But just as important, and this is not just for students with IEPs, but all students, is really making sure students also have the other college and career readiness skills and habits to be able to do well and participate in their communities and go on and live independently. So for students with IEPs, the law actually requires IEP teams to look at both academic and functional skills. And functional skills might be skills around social and emotional supports for students, adaptive supports for students, helping students around to be more independent. Self-determination is something that I hope we get a chance to talk about because it's so critically important to incorporate into the special education process so students really understand themselves as learners, are able to self-advocate for their own needs, are able to work through problems and discuss their abilities as well as their needs and seek out supports independently so that they're ready for, what lies next after they leave high school.
Talking to Daniel Parker, Assistant Director of the Special Education Team at Wisconsin's Department of Public Instruction, looking at individualized educational programs for students often with disabilities or special learning needs, how they work here in Wisconsin. Daniel, all the things you're talking about, this team approach, bringing people together, figuring out the students' needs and solving it, sounds great. It sounds like a lot of resources. It's labor intensive for schools that already, in some cases, are stretched thin. They've got a lot on their plates. Does it work out as well in practice as it does in theory?
Well, in my experience, it has. I mean, I'm very fortunate. I started my career in Lawrence, Kansas, in a traditional public school back in the 90s, and the first program I began working in education had students with autism who had significant communication needs. Many of them use alternative communication devices. They had very significant movement needs, falling to the floor, lots of behaviors that were explosive or, extremely, I always thought of special education, you have to be a problem solver and love problem solving. To be able to, really work with families, work with the team to try to figure out students' needs. And, you know, this is back in the 90s, and we were including those students with general education peers in traditional school programs. We were doing social skills groups with those students and working on skills around communication and engaging with peers. It definitely is a lot of work, but, you know, if you have a good system that is developed and good teams and knowledgeable staff, you're really able to do some pretty incredible things. We talk a lot about high expectations, and a lot of that, you know, I think sometimes expectations is a social construct. One of the things I like to do with groups is to ask people, what did the world of people with disabilities look like 30 or 40 years ago? If you think back in time, and many of your listeners, I'm sure, are able to think back to their school experiences 30 or 40 years ago, and what was the expectations of somebody with Down syndrome, or what was the expectation, where were students with autism in the 1970s and the 1980s, where were they being educated? And when you do this, you often will have people talk about experiences where they didn't see students with disabilities in schools. Many students back in those days were institutionalized, and the expectations of what we thought was possible was so much different than today. And now, you know, we have totally different experiences. We have early childhood inclusion programs. There's a beautiful video on our website of a district who is full inclusion early childhood program, and their parents talk about their child who they feared how they would be able to engage with other peers, or what would people think if they were in school because their behaviors were so different and their needs were so different. But the team comes together and they can see their child learning all types of skills in that environment that were honestly not even thought possible years ago. And if you look today and you look at college programs even, I was actually sitting next to a gentleman, Dr. James Collins at UW-Whitewater, who started a brand new program at UW-Whitewater called UW-Whitewater Life Program, which is a program for students with intellectual disabilities to go to college at UW-Whitewater, live in the dorms, go to prep rallies, go to basketball games, do all the things all the other students do, go to leisure classes, and they also get additional supports in a college program. And those are Think College programs. Wisconsin actually has 5 Think College programs in Wisconsin for students with more significant disabilities, such as intellectual disabilities, autism, students with Down syndrome, or other commonly known disability types. And you know, in the 90s, even in the program I was in that was an inclusive program, you know, back then having students go to a public school was unthinkable, what was just happening, and going to college might have been unthinkable, but today there's programs like this popping up all over the country. So I think our expectations have changed greatly over time, and we're realizing the great abilities that students with disabilities have when we provide them with that access and engagement and opportunity to participate with their grade level peers.
We're talking about students with disabilities, whether they're supported in high school classrooms and whether they're challenged in those classrooms and encouraged to aim high in their futures. Daniel Parker is with us, Assistant Director of the Special Education Team in the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you the parent or teacher of a student with disabilities? Are you seeing your child grow and learn and plan for the future? Are you a person with disabilities yourself? What was your school experience like? Did you feel like you had the support you need, and that there were expectations that you would be shooting for the same level, the same degree, the same diploma everybody else was? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. We're talking about high school students with disabilities and whether they're being challenged enough in classrooms and thinking about their future, being prepared for maybe college or a career. Daniel Parker is with us, Assistant Director of the Special Education Team at Wisconsin's Department of Public Instruction. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you or were you a student with disabilities? What was your school experience like? Did you feel like you came out prepared for college, for a career? If you're a teacher, parent, friend, or sibling of a student with disabilities, love to hear from you too. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Paul is with us in Menominee Falls. Paul, hi.
Hi, thanks for the show. Great show. I just want to say I am a special ed teacher, and I work with middle school and high school students. And it would be nice if Mr. Parker would talk about the PTP, the post-secondary transition plan. One of the challenges that we find is that there aren't enough graduation alternatives for the high school students. The classes that are offered in the high school generally tend to be college prep classes. Some of them are applicable, but you find that you're really trying, especially for the students that have specific learning disabilities, that they're really just trying to keep their head above water to get that quote-unquote high school diploma and then move to a secondary, post-secondary kind of institution or some type of training so that they can, you know, move their career forward. So that's a challenge that we're finding, that there isn't enough flexibility at the high school level to do academic programming that's specific for the needs of the students because of the requirements of the 22 graduation credits that they have to have. And I'm sure that Mr. Parker is familiar with this and the challenges. Great show. Appreciate it.
Paul, thanks for the call. Daniel, what do you think?
Yeah, thanks, Paul, for that question. So a little bit about the post-secondary transition planning. So to give some background to your listeners, so high school teachers work with students and their families to develop a transition plan starting by age 14 in Wisconsin that must include a post-school education and training goal. So in other words, all high school students with an IEP must identify what education or job training they will need after high school to achieve their goals. So school services then support the desired post-school education and training by offering courses, transition services to prepare the student to be ready for higher education or on-the-job training listed in those post-secondary transition plans. So, you know, certainly districts in Wisconsin go about different ways of supporting students with disabilities with post-secondary options in completing the graduation requirements. To my knowledge, there is some flexibility in how local school boards can also look at courses that meet the qualifications of what the state lays out for graduation requirements. So there are sometimes courses that school boards and districts will come up with that have alternative classes that meet the graduation requirements. So that might be something for districts to look into and what options they might want to consider to be able to do that. There's also a really great resource that our department funds through some federal special education discretionary funding called the Transition Improvement Grant, or TIG. So our Transition Improvement Grant has grant staff around the state of Wisconsin, and they work with the Cooperative Educational Service Agencies around Wisconsin as well. But because they're a grant through our department, through our special education team, they provide free technical assistance and supports. They have an amazing website of resources for transition planning. They have a transition planning app where students can help be more involved in their transition planning. They have lessons for teachers to help support the types of skills needed to help students move towards employment outcomes and be ready for post-secondary education after high school. So that could be a really good resource to look at that is available statewide. And they have regional coordinators too, which is really nice. So if you if you go to the TIG website, you can find a coordinator that kind of knows your region of the state, knows some of the resources that are there, knows the school districts, and can help provide that more tailored, individualized support for educators or school districts looking to improve their programs.
Paul, thanks for the call. Go next to Christy with us in Manitowoc. Christy, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Christy?
Well, my daughter has dyslexia. She got no help.
In the schools, Christy?
Correct. So she's going to graduate. It's good. But the school really hurt her.
Well, I'm sorry.
By not helping. The school really hurt her by not helping her.
Christy, I'm sorry to hear your story. Good luck to you and your daughter. Christy, seeing her daughter with dyslexia, Daniel, not getting the help. So in the case of a student with dyslexia, what kind of support, what kind of boost could the school give?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things I definitely want to encourage callers to know that there are federal protections for students with disabilities. The Department of Public Instruction has a number of mechanisms and how If parents or teachers have concerns about the educational programs that students have, definitely contact the Department of Public Instruction. There's a variety of options. We have a Wisconsin statewide mediation system to other dispute resolution options where we do, we are actually authorized to do investigations around families or anyone on behalf of a child feels a student is not receiving the special education that the legal protections provide around the federal and state laws around special education. So I want to make sure people are aware of that availability to contact the department to find out what your options are if you feel that students aren't meeting it. The other thing is, one of the things that we have done in the last few years is we've really shifted our guidance on the IEP process to focus not just on compliance with the laws, because there's lots of regulations around timelines and processes, around parents being invited to the IEP meeting, certain things that must happen. But we've really we've looked at the trends nationally. We've looked at the trends in Wisconsin around the achievement of students with IEPs compared to their peers. And although we have increased in our ability to meet the compliance requirements of the laws, and when I say we, school districts have done a very good job of meeting the compliance requirements, we haven't seen the outcomes that we might want to see. So our guidance on IEPs, and we actually branded it College and Career Ready IEPs, Improving Student Outcomes for Students 3 through 21, really focuses on IEP teams getting good information about a student, including information that parents bring to the table, really having an in-depth discussion of why is the student struggling. So, if a student is struggling with specific learning disability-related areas, what is that root cause? Why is that individual student? What are the needs that they have that are going to help them better access, engage, and make progress in their curriculum?
And I want to jump in, Daniel, and bring on one more caller before we're out of time. Jake is with us in Madison. Jake, hi.
Oh, yes, hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Jake?
Well, this is an interesting conversation. Thanks for having it. I am a college professor here in the Midwest, and as these students are, creating these plans and coming through the high school system, we're increasingly seeing them, in our classrooms and in higher ed. And one of the challenges we have there is that students are not always required or not required at all to self-disclose as any accommodations or any sorts of learning disabilities or challenges or things that might interfere with their learning. And so many times these students become embedded a semester or two in our systems before those challenges have, translated into poor academics and other kinds of problems. And then
got it, Jake. I want to jump in just briefly. Daniel, some good news there, seeing more students with special needs and making it to college is the next step, very briefly, to help them at that next higher education level, make sure their needs are met.
And right now, about 11% of students disclose as having a disability. And one of the big differences between college and K-12 education is in K-12, districts are responsible for identifying students with a disability and serving them. In college, as your caller stated, they have to disclose. And I'm so happy your caller called, because one of the big pushes we're trying to encourage is IEP teams working with students with disabilities in K-12 should really help students build that self-determination.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Daniel Parker, Assistant Director of the Special Education Team at the State's Department of Public Instruction. It is National Grilled Cheese Day for some reason. I'm not sure why today or why now, but it is, and it's out there, and famous people, including people from Wisconsin, are tweeting up a storm about it, and we've got a fan of the genre here, J. Carlisle Larson.
Yeah, I would consider myself a diehard fan of grilled cheese sandwiches. Huge fan.
Well, now, I like grilled cheese fine. It's not something that I'm going to get real worked up about. But what is it about a grilled cheese that gets you like really excited about it? I mean, cheese is great. Great, sure.
I mean, one, it's melted cheese, which is amazing. On bread, which is also amazing. It's very, very variable. You can do all sorts of different stuff with it. But it's also like really comforting at times. If you just want a warm sandwich that's easy to put together, grilled cheese.
And now you can get a lot of fancy grilled cheese sandwiches at restaurants and in cookbooks all over the place. My kids like, or they used to like grilled cheese as like straight up as you can get white bread, slices of cheese that you peel out of the plastic.
Yeah,
ideally,
plastic.
They would accept cheddar because they like cheddar.
Sure.
But nothing. They don't want three cheese grilled cheese sandwiches on funky bread.
They don't want like white truffle oil on their grilled cheese sandwiches.
But you do.
I will. I'm not a grilled cheese snob, but I'm also not a grilled cheese purist. I totally am on board with the American cheese grilled cheese, but also for, you know, a fancier grilled cheese.
Enjoy your grilled cheese tonight on National Grilled Cheese Day. Big contest coming up in Dodgeville in 2 weeks. This is Central Time.